All right. So as we begin, I kind of maybe mentioned last week that this format tonight is going to be a little bit different. It's going to be more practical in our application, or taking what we know about finances in general in this life and be a little more practical in applying that. So it's going to look a little different, less of the time in the Word, but hopefully helpful to you guys, and pray that it is fruitful for your conversations going forward. So as we kind of begin exploring these practical applications of personal finance and stewardship in that area, I want to take a moment to encourage those of you that are doing well in this area to keep it up. All right. So if your current approach is working, stay the course and continue your faithful stewardship in this area. I don't want to say what I do tonight would just say we're going to scrap our plan and do that. No, keep pressing on if you feel you're doing well, and it makes sense for you guys to do what you're doing. This lesson is also designed to equip you, if you're doing well, to help others too. So better help them with what you're doing, or say, all right, hey, I know some other good ideas I learned. This is helpful as well. So use these principles as a reference when mentoring or encouraging someone else. I pray that's helpful for you in that way. This will help you explain the nuts and bolts of, I guess, sound financial practices and principles in a way that's clear and accessible for anyone. And for those of you who know this is an area where you need guidance, I'd say take heart. My hope is that what we cover tonight will give you encouragement and direction, not a sense of stomp you down mentality. So I say encouragement and direction so you can take what we learned tonight and step into the necessary conversations, help you make wise changes and grow in faithfulness with what God has entrusted you. So no matter which Christian approach to personal finance you choose to follow, you'll find that the most share a common approach, guiding you toward wise and faithful stewardship in how you manage your money. And so tonight, I will break this into several steps, and these steps are meant to be started as of yesterday. So if you needed a spot to start yesterday, was great. There's no delay in what we're talking about tonight. So if you're struggling to get a handle on your personal financial stewardship, I'll present the approach that is recommended from the best minds that I've read in this area, from folks like Jim Neuheiser, who wrote the Money, Debt, and Finances book, James Ricard, Dave Ramsey, Larry Burkett, several others as well. But before we start this process, I'm going to trust you have created a budget. Or if you are walking someone through this, make sure they have established their budget. That's the critical piece. To show us the landscape, then, will help us tackle each of these steps. I didn't mention it last week, but when we kind of talked about the budget, there are several tools out there that I think are helpful. Some of you feel comfortable enough with just a spreadsheet program, opening that up and going to town there. Some of you that might need more help, there's tools like Monarch is one. I personally enjoyed that one a lot. Dave Ramsey has one through Every Dollar. You Need a Budget, or if you're the hardcore, it's known as YNAB for those that use that. So all those kind of have some free options, minus the Monarch one. I know it's strictly pay one, but all have costs under or at $100 or under that. So we're not talking about spending a lot. If you need help in that area, it's a wise investment to do so. So I know people that use each one of those. So if you if I'm not familiar with it, I can kind of maybe point you in the direction should you need some guidance there. So if you need some encouragement in this area or where to get on track, here are some steps we'll walk through tonight that many have recommended and followed to put themselves on stable financial ground. All right, so step number one, start an emergency fund. The first course of action is that we need to establish an emergency fund. So life is unpredictable, and having an emergency fund is acting with prudence, as we read Proverbs 21:20. Most financial teachers recommend starting with $1,000 to $1,500 in that emergency fund. That's just enough to absorb like an unexpected car repair, a sudden medical bill, or maybe a job delay. I almost think stretching that to $1,500 to $2,000 is reasonable as well. So a lot of the things I've read are dated in the sense that $1,000 was a little more back 10, 15 years ago than it is now. So I'm comfortable saying how much, like up to that $2,000 range. All right, so this prevents the need to go into more debt when crisis hits. Remember, Scripture is pro-saving and being proactive. It actually commends the ant, as we learned, to store up in the summer, as we read in Proverbs 6, as in the previous lessons, multiple times. So beginning with your financial journey with a small buffer brings peace and stability. It's not about hoarding, it's about wise financial oversight or foresight. Saving for emergencies creates space for more faithful living. While you're still working on debt or other goals, this small cushion will help prevent some derailment. So as you use that, an emergency comes along, as you use that, you're going to pause your steps that we walk through tonight, and you'll rebuild that cushion up. So some people already have a small emergency fund, but if you don't have this is step number one. So if your current financial situation doesn't leave room for an emergency fund, if every dollar you earn is already spoken for, then you've got some extra work ahead of you, but it's going to be worth the effort. I will tell you that. All right, so start by evaluating any existing debt. If you have debt, identify those minimum payment amounts. So for now, commit to making only those minimum payments so you can redirect any available funds toward building this emergency fund. Once that foundation is in place, you'll be in a better position to tackle the debt more aggressively, and we'll talk through that, how to navigate that. And so the second thing to consider is, after you've evaluated maybe where things are, debt help that's preventing you maybe from this emergency fund, the second thing to look at is bringing in more income. All right, we're going to work smarter, work harder to put ourselves in the right position, but sometimes some additional part-time work might be a must in this situation. So the first step is to establish an emergency fund. And step two is eliminate consumer debt. Step two is eliminating consumer debt. We talked about the biggest hindrance to your budget is debt. All right, so debt ties up our cash through required payments each month. That's a given. We learned last week it is enslaving. Debt is enslaving. Proverbs 22:7. It makes everything you buy more expensive as money goes to pay it back with interest. So debt is stressful, as you often find out. And debt can put someone behind financially, inevitably, until it is paid off. Most biblical financial teachers emphasize repaying all consumer debt, credit cards, car loans, personal loans, before tackling your larger financial goals. And I would agree with them. Dave Ramsey promotes the debt snowball method, paying off smallest to largest, and they do that for motivation reasons. We'll walk through that here in a moment. While others like Jim Neuheiser, he urges just a principle-based approach, avoiding new debt and focusing on contentment. He speaks highly of the debt snowball method, but he also speaks to the heart more than Dave Ramsey does. So the goal isn't just to get out of debt, but to change the behaviors and desires that led to it in the first place. So freedom from debt means no longer being mastered by monthly payments or interest rates. It restores flexibility and puts us in a position to save and give generously, like we've talked about. The process is, you guessed it, going to be hard, but the spiritual and financial rewards are lasting. All right, so this isn't just a temporary thing. The goal is to make this a change in lifestyle, too, as we take our walk down these steps. From personal experience and from talking to others, it seems the debt snowball method as a debt reduction strategy has been the most helpful. One benefit is that it keeps you motivated, like I mentioned. So I want to show you that example of the debt snowball method. It involves paying off debt in order of smallest balance to your largest balance. You gain momentum as you knock out each balance from that point. When the smallest debt is paid in full, you roll the minimum payment that you were making on that debt into the next smallest debt payment, and so forth. All right, so here's an example of how the debt snowball works. All right, so step number one, we're going to list your debts from smallest to largest, regardless of interest rate. I say the only exception I would have to this would be to pay off any tax debt that you might have with the IRS or state entity before anything else. You don't want them coming in the middle of this and taking things from you. So put any debts you might owe for back taxes, stuff like that, at the top of your priority list. But then next, we're going to list the following debts in order from smallest to largest. And so in our example here, we have the following debts and minimum payments. I threw in a credit card of $1,575, the minimum payment being $25. We have an auto loan for $8,500 remaining on that. The minimum payment each month is $350. A medical bill for $10,000, just came with a minimum payment of $200 on that. And a student loan for $20,000, the minimum payment being $100. So now on to step two. We're going to make minimum payments on all your debts except the smallest debt. So at a minimum, we're going to make at least the minimum payments required on the other debts to help keep them satisfied, keep them off your back. We don't want our car to be repoed while we're trying to pay off our debt. That puts us in a bind. It takes us backwards. And then also step three, we're going to throw as much extra money as you can on your smallest debt until it's gone. So at the same time, we're going to do what we can to generate more to throw at the first debt until it is gone. Maybe some things are obvious. Maybe you have something you can sell to generate more cash. The best thing you can do is part ways with something that has a large loan balance on it currently. Maybe selling the camper you don't use as much as you thought you would. Maybe it's downsizing a car to get into a smaller payment for the time being. Maybe you're more aggressive in the job hunt. You work smarter, work harder, like we've talked about. And you see those gains pay off in the sector with your work. It leads to more income that way. So maybe it's just doing the budget and realizing you have 10 subscriptions to things you don't need. I think that hits home sometimes. Whatever it is, we are going to work on attacking the debt as quickly as possible in these steps. So for our example, you've somehow managed to come up with $500 extra per month to throw at the debt. So as we look at this, it's going to take 3 months to pay off our first debt. We take the minimum payment plus our $500 extra on the credit card. And the 525 times 3 is the 1,575. In my example, I'm not using any interest into that. Just make things simple for us and save you guys. I don't want to nerd out too bad on you guys. But so if we're just looking at strictly just payments, not considering interest, this is what the breakdown is going to be. So we see the first debt has been paid. And remember, we have just paid the minimum on everything but the credit card. So after 3 months, those balances would be adjusted as so. Our auto loan's down to the $7,450, our medical bill's $9,400, and the student loan's at $19,700. So now that we've paid off our first debt, we are ready for step four. Step four is take what you were paying on your smallest debt and add that to your payment on the next smallest debt until it's gone too. So for example, after paying off the first debt, you take the $525 a month, which is our $500 extra plus the $25 minimum payment of the first debt, the credit card, and we're going to throw it at the next debt. So starting in the fourth month, you begin paying $875. So that's the $525 plus $350, the minimum auto loan payment was. We're going to throw that towards the debt. And so here are the balances at the start of the fourth month, like we just talked about, what we set up. All right, now we're ready for step five. We're going to repeat this process until each debt is paid in full after month. So after each month, we're going to keep, as we knock out a debt, we're going to replace it, that payment, towards the next debt. We're going to keep doing this until we're debt-free, so we're going to see that momentum. So for our example, after paying off the two debts, you now have a total payment of $1,075 a month that we're going to throw towards the debt. That's $525 plus $350 plus $200. So starting in the 13th month, you're down to the final few debts, and your balances are now as follows. You can see that on the screen. If we keep this up, our debt's going to be paid off in 35 months, which from where you were at, that seems amazing in our example here. So if everything remained constant, and like I said, not factoring any interest in for simplicity's sake, after 35 months, we'll have this paid off. $40,000 in 35 months. So in the latter months, as your snowball is the biggest, you would have $1,175 dollars going to pay off debt. And that's not even if you did anything else to increase that as you go along. So as you knock out your debts one by one, the amount of money you have to throw at the rest of your debt grows. That's that snowball that we're talking about, rolling down the hill. So and the excitement you get from paying off your smallest debt super quickly will motivate you to keep going and going and going, plowing your way through the debt all the way to that finish line. All right? So this method isn't saving money on interest, and that's not what we, I think, ultimately should be concerned about if we're in a mess that's kind of locking us in. it's more of a mental exercise. It's to help you see the progress, help you keep you motivated and stay on track. So any debt repayment method you choose, you may need to pause your debt repayment for a short time to deal with those unexpected or expensive situations that pop up. Like maybe having a baby sets you back with medical bills. You've lost your job temporarily. You're dealing with a health crisis. You're going through just a major life change that causes a blip on the radar. But just to be sure to get that debt payment going and rolling again as soon as you can, once you're past that emergency crisis or crisis period. All right, some would question even stopping investing in retirement to pay off debt. Here's a few reasons I would pay off debt before continuing pursuing retirement funding even further. So number one is a guaranteed return. So paying off debt gives you a guaranteed return equal to the interest rate you're avoiding. So for example, if you're paying off a credit card at 18%, that's like earning a risk-free 18% return, far better than typical stock market returns. We'll just say 8% over a longer period. Number two, it's just freedom from financial bondage in general. So Proverbs 27, the borrower is slave to the lender. So debt limits your options as you walk through life. Paying it off restores financial and personal freedom. You're no longer working for your creditors. You're now putting your money to better use. Number three, better stewardship and relationships. Paying off debt builds discipline. It builds contentment and self-control. Biblical virtues are foundational to godly financial habits. So it helps break those materialistic tendencies, fosters a mindset of faithful stewardship over ownership. So especially as debt creates stress, anxiety, and even that marital tension, I think we've been there. It's important that becoming debt-free will help you in those relationships as well. We're after the heart. So number four, benefits to paying off your debt before focusing again on their retirement is increased cash flow for giving and saving. So once the debt is gone, those payments that you were throwing at your debt can be used for and redirected for giving and saving. So your generosity, more can be given to the church, investing. We'll look at like retirement and education later, but those investing goals can start to be hit when you have no debt to worry about. Emergency savings and future goals that you might have with it become options on the table. So you regain the margin. It increases your flexibility and stability. And number five, there's less risk in uncertain times. So without the monthly debt obligations, you're less vulnerable to any job loss or economic downturns. Debt-free living offers just a greater simplistic and resilience in a lifestyle and readiness for crisis. And number six, paying off the debt instead of investing in retirement avoids the market volatility. Investing in the stock market involves risk and uncertainty like many have seen. But paying off debt is a sure thing, not dependent on the swings and the market crashes that may exist over the period of you paying off your debt. So those are a few reasons that I would suggest pausing funding your retirement and focusing on the debt. And before I forget, just so we are clear, I wouldn't tell someone to stop their desired giving in this process. Now, we talked about God loves a cheerful giver. And as we walked through our lesson on giving, I don't see that there would be wisdom or a command to pause giving because it is strictly tied to the heart. And so we want to support that and encourage that. All right, on this next slide, next two slides, I guess, I want to look at some wise principles on borrowing. I don't have a lot of time to really walk through them, but I wanted to at least show them to you as you read through. If you want this later anytime, just let me know. Reach out to me and I can send you those. But I think going forward, debt would ultimately like to be the goal to stay out of. Hopefully when you do something like a debt snowball method that you feel so good about that you don't want to return to back where you were and take a few steps back. But right now, as you navigate, I would just suggest making the maximum down payment you can and borrow as little as possible. Look at the monthly payments. Do they even fit within your budget before you pursue that? Things like borrowing money for a car, I know how real that need is. But if you can avoid borrowing money for something that depreciates and plummets in value, avoid that if possible. Like I said, debt is just makes things more expensive and reduces is your lifestyle. The higher the interest rate, the greater the harm is done. And so there's just a few more to just avoid putting yourself, number nine, in a position where you owe more for something that you could quickly receive if you had to sell the item quickly. And then make it your goal, like I said, to be completely debt-free. Hopefully that's clear as we navigate. And I wasn't sure where to put this next blurb, but this section on consumer debt is probably most applicable. Some financial advisors speak very strongly against owning credit cards. I think their heart is focused on the trap that many have fallen into by using them. Part of me sees them as helpful, but only if you have them under control and pay off their balance in full each month. So they are helpful for two reasons. I think they offer some more security than your debit card, which is tied directly to your bank. More security against those fraudulent transactions that seem to be more prevalent in an online shopping environment. And so that keeps your bank account from being exposed. Second, they do provide some helpful reward opportunities, but I would strongly say, but do not let this be your focus. If you're prone to overspend and do not pay off the balance monthly, then those rewards are meaningless. We're just chasing nothing. But if you do have the discipline to pay them off every month, or you know that a credit card causes you to overspend, then I strongly urge you not to use them. Also, while we were talking about debt, I want to mention some points on some auto debt. Most of the Christian financial teachers we've discussed, the Dave Ramsey, the Larry Burkett's, the Jim Neuheisers, James Ricards, are united on this point. Auto loans should be avoided whenever possible. So while a car might not be seen as a necessity in today's world, taking on debt to buy one is not always a necessity. So these teachers teach that cars are one of the worst things to borrow money for because they rapidly depreciate. So the car you're driving is going down in value faster than you can pay it off. I, with them, would encourage saving up and then paying cash, even as most of a significant down payment that you can. So even if that means driving an older, less flashy vehicle in the short term. The goal is to avoid owning more on something that's losing value every day. So vehicles end up costing way more because of the interest. So avoid, and I strongly say avoid leasing vehicles as the most expensive way to drive a vehicle. Often we found it's usually much cheaper to repair the old vehicle than to replace it. So on average, the car repair is going to cost less than a traditional car payment in the United States on a newer vehicle. So once you see the benefits of repairing a vehicle versus buying a new one, I think your gag reflex goes up on future repairs. You're able to stomach more knowing you have a paid-for vehicle at that point. Now, there's certain auto repairs that would not make sense to make, and I would hope that you could walk through that. And see, we're not going to make a car repair more than our vehicle is probably worth. So something else to consider, co-signing a loan is one of the riskiest financial decisions you can make. Scripture warns against it clearly in Proverbs 17:18. A man lacking a heart of wisdom strikes his hands in pledge and becomes guarantor in the presence of his neighbor. So when you co-sign, you take on full responsibility for the debt if the borrower fails to pay, yet you receive no benefit of that purchase. Lenders only usually require a cosigner when they view the borrower as a high risk, so that risk is then getting transferred to you. So if the loan goes unpaid, you'll be held liable, potentially facing serious financial consequences for doing so. So in short, cosigning may feel helpful if you get approached to do that, but it can leave you burdened with debt that isn't yours. So biblical wisdom would urge us to avoid those relationships and transactions. So that's our blurb about debt. Now that we've paid off our debt, we're ready for step three. Step three is fully fund emergency savings. We're going to fully fund our emergency savings. We have the starter emergency fund we established in step one. Our next step is to build a fully funded emergency fund for 3 to 6 months worth of expenses. So this fund provides a long-term financial security and prepares you to weather, like I said, job loss on a more serious level, illness, or other major disruptions. So not sure where to fall in that 3 to 6 month range. I'm going to say that depends on your household's income stability and responsibilities. So here are some helpful guidelines. Aim for the 3 months of expenses on the lower end, or the lower end of this, if you're single with no dependents and have stable income, or if you're married and both spouses have steady, reliable jobs. You're going to aim for the lower end of that. Aim for the higher end, or the 6 months of expenses, if you're married and living on a single income, if you're a single parent, if your work is seasonal or inconsistent, someone in your household has ongoing health issues, or you or your spouse is self-employed, commission-based, or has highly irregular income. Aim for the higher end, or the 6 months on those situations. So this may change and adjust as situations change and adjust. But those are some general guidelines I would follow in choosing where to fall at in this step. So at a minimum, this should be these expenses that you use to kind of calculate this should be the four pillars they say of the budget: housing, food, utilities, and transportation. What are your necessary expenses in those four categories? Again, those are housing, food, utilities, and transportation. Right? So you may initially fund your emergency fund at a higher level. If we look at numbers, like at our budget, I'm going to be tendency to go higher, but that's throwing in some fluff items, I guess you could say. But I'm sure you'll learn to cut those out if there really was truly an emergency. Those are going to be the first things that get cut. So now that you know how much to save, the next question is where should you keep an emergency fund? The key is liquidity. All right, your emergency fund needs to be easily accessible when an urgent expense arises. We don't want to have to go through many people to get to that money. So this means it should be stored somewhere safe, stable, and readily available. So here are some of the best options to do that. I would say a basic savings account is probably the easiest. Something that's linked to your checking account for quick transfers back and forth, maybe online or just going down to the bank. Second would be a money market account, and that offers maybe some debit card access or check writing privileges in that. And then third would be a high yield savings account that earns interest and allows fast direct transfers. So where not to keep it? Well, obviously not in a shoebox under your mattress or buried in your backyard, but things like stocks, mutual funds, any investment account where the value could either drop unexpectedly or you have to talk to someone, get permission to start that transaction, I guess. Hey, initiate moving funds out of this for me. That's just too much of a delay that you don't want to deal with. And also those investments, your emergency fund here is not meant to grow wealth. It's just a financial self-insurance, so to speak. It's not an investment. So we want to keep it protected and accessible and ready for any, I guess, to serve its purpose where you would need it most. So let's say a surprise expense shows up and suddenly it feels like an emergency, but before reaching for the emergency fund, before cracking that bank open, you need to pause and ask, is this truly an emergency? All right, so first consider whether you can adjust your monthly budget to shoulder that. Are there non-essential categories like our dining out or entertainment fund that we can temporarily reduce to cover the costs? So if so, let's say reworking your budget is the better first step to take. The less you withdraw from your emergency fund, the less you'll need to rebuild later. But if what you've trimmed in your budget still comes up short, that's when it's time to ask three questions. Is it unexpected? Is it necessary? And is it urgent? So if the answer is yes to all three, you're likely dealing with a genuine emergency. And so using the emergency fund would be appropriate and wise at that time. If not, the expense may need to wait or be planned for in another way. Take another route. So remember, a true emergency fund is for real life disruptions, not predictable events that we see coming. So once the emergency account is fully funded in place, it's time to take the extra money that we have found in our budget, we're working hard to increase, and we're ready for the next step. The next step is to take the extra money and begin fully investing in retirement. So we're going to begin fully funding our retirement investments. So I haven't found a biblical financial teacher that disagrees with this statement. Saving for retirement is a wise and biblical expression of stewardship. Proverbs 6 commends the ant for preparing in advance, and Proverbs 13:22 speaks of a good man leaving inheritance for his children's children. So retirement savings, is like we've talked about, isn't about hoarding, it's about planning. So while we don't know the future, it's prudent to prepare for the day when income may decrease or stop altogether, just and certain life events as we get to certain ages. So by setting aside money gradually over time, we reflect diligence in the process. We reflect foresight and care for the future responsibilities. And everyone agrees that getting the debt paid off and your budget under control and emergency fund established is essential before this step. All right, so though they endorse retirement saving, most counselors warn against making retirement an idol in general. The world often paints retirement as the ultimate goal. It's a time to indulge, disengage, and serve the self. But we know biblical wisdom calls for a different mindset. Retirement is not an escape from responsibility, but a transition to new forms of service even. So the best ones emphasize that our identity and security must remain in Christ, not in financial independence. Retirement should be planned for, but never and not worshipped. Retirement is not a time to take a back seat in the church. Quite the opposite. Financial independence is valuable only when it is used to glorify God and serve others. A well-prepared retiree can mentor younger generations. They have more time to volunteer because they're not spending time at work. They give generously and live with purpose in that way. So this vision transforms retirement from self-focused season to God-honoring opportunity. There's a great opportunity for you once you've retired to invest even more in time and energy into serving Christ's church. So the sooner you can invest in funding your retirement, the quicker you can walk away from your vocation, and that's something to be celebrated. For most people, Social Security will not provide sufficient income to maintain their lifestyle. So in January 2025, for example, that monthly average in the U.S. was $1,976. So we need to be thinking about additional sources of income on top of any pension-type plans. Some helpful points on investing while we're talking about investing in general. I would say invest consistently over time. Don't try to time the market. Instead, invest steadily and patiently. Use funds that prioritize long-term growth over short-term gains. Avoid get-rich-quick schemes and high-risk speculation. Be cautious with risky investments. Speculation and trends promising quick profits. Those often lead to loss and reveal a heart that is of greed rather than the one that trusts God. Understand what you're investing in. Invest only in what you understand. If you don't know how an investment works, don't commit to it. Seek wise counsel and do due diligence. For example, I don't fully understand how Bitcoin works, and I'm just not going to invest in it. That's my decision because I don't understand how it totally works. And so know what you're investing in and understand what you're investing in. If Bitcoin works for you and you understand it, go for it. Another point, don't let wealth become your security. So while investing is wise, placing your trust in accounts is not. So we're not watching those accounts daily. Earthly investments can fail, but the Lord, like we know, never does. Be a steward, not a market watcher. And also important, diversify your investments. So we know diversification helps reduce risk. Don't put all your resources into one place. Don't put them in the same basket. Spread them out wisely and prayerfully. And maybe that looks some money in retirement funds. Maybe you want to pursue investing in real estate. Whatever it is, don't put all your resources into one place. Other helpful tips is start early. So the earlier you begin investing for retirement, the more time your money has to grow. We see the effects of compound interest. Even modest investments in your 20s can result in substantial growth over several decades. So time is one of your most powerful financial tools. So as we walk through thinking of the debt snowball, think how much time you can earn back by the quicker you plow through your debt and have free up more money to do that. Other helpful things is maximize your employer contributions. If your employer offers to match your retirement contributions, take full advantage of that when the time's ready. It's essentially free money. So failing to contribute enough to receive the full match to maybe your company's 401k is leaving 100% return on the table. Consider Roth accounts, especially for the younger age. Roth IRAs and a Roth 401k are funded with after-tax dollars. And then when you get older into the retirement age, those withdrawals are going to be tax-free. So you'll never pay tax when you take it out. It grows tax-free over all those years. I think these are helpful and beneficial as you look to retirement age, feeling like you might be in a higher tax bracket later in life. Roths allow your money to grow tax-free and take them out tax-free when you retire. So that avoids tax at a higher bracket than maybe what you're sitting at right now. The other point is don't withdraw early. So we're going to avoid taking money out of retirement accounts before retirement age. Early withdrawals are often penalized in tax. And so when you take the money out and pay the tax, pay the penalty, you're actually going backwards. You're losing money. You're coughing up money that you should have held onto. And they reduce your long-term savings potential. And I would suggest strongly avoid borrowing against retirement funds. So while some plans allow loans from your account, borrowing slows your investment growth and risks your retirement security if not repaid promptly. So try to avoid that if at all possible. And then we're going to adjust to risk as retirement nears. So as over these years, as you're throwing in money at a very more aggressive, maybe in a more aggressive plan, while those are nearing retirement, should shift to more stable, conservative investments. You kind of get more maybe into the treasury bonds or cash equivalents. Target date funds adjust automatically to the mix over time. So some, this is maybe more talk if you have a financial advisor, they can set target date funds. So as you age, your funds adjust appropriately. So while you're starting up your retirement funding, you are also beginning to look at step five. This is step four. We're also going to be looking at step five, which is save for major expenses at the same time. So step five is save for major expenses. So while we're saving for retirement, we're also looking at the next big purchase. So whether it be you wanting to pay cash for your next car, or maybe you've been renting and want to have a larger down payment on a home, or maybe you want to think about college funding for kids. Paying cash for things is what we do now. That's our new life shift after our debt snowball work, our hard work we put into that. So another step to work on when doing step four and step five is working to pay off your mortgage early. So we're doing a lot of this all at once. It's kind of another shift in how we're approaching things. So pay off your home mortgage early. When it comes to financing or managing our finances, few decisions have as much long-term impact as the one we make about where we live. Housing is usually the largest single expense on a person's budget. And because of that, it's often the biggest area of either wise stewardship or financial trouble we see quite often. So if we consider debt, we have consumer debt, which is things we buy and lifestyle choices we make. A home mortgage is typically thought of more wisely as a way to steward things well and buy something that typically would appreciate in value over time, which is what we talked about versus a vehicle which would depreciate or decline over time. So once you're investing and saving, consider making extra payments on your mortgage to pay this off early. This frees up long-term income and aligns with the biblical principles of avoiding servitude to the lenders. And there are very few voices that would say not to pay off your home early. Most champion paying it off early. It makes sense. One extra payment per year, all towards principal, can dramatically reduce interest and shorten the loan term. A paid-off home brings peace, lowers expenses every month, and creates margin for ministry. Before we get into finances of an actual home buy, and I wanted to address some things you hear coming from the culture around us quite a bit. Perhaps it's your Uncle Bill or Aunt Sally who knows best. So many assume that buying a home versus renting is always the wiser financial choice. They say, you need to buy right away. You got to buy. Got to buy. So the truth is that there are many times where renting can serve an important and God-honoring purpose at certain times in your life, certain seasons, and is the wise choice for some folks. So renting offers flexibility and reduced responsibility. In many cases, could be a lower financial burden in general, especially for those that are in transition, they're starting out or recovering financially. So Scripture never commands home ownership as a mark of godliness or success or faithfulness. What matters most is whether they're being faithful with what they've been entrusted with. So renting can be a wise decision when you aren't ready to take on burdensome debt, whether you're ready not to drain savings or get locked into a commitment prematurely. So if a person is relocating, uncertain about their future employment, or still working to pay off consumer debt, then renting allows for stability without a long-term risk. So it makes sense in some cases. There's a huge danger to overextending financially just to buy a home. There is the need to warn against making major purchases like a house during seasons of instability. So in those times, renting provides the space to regain financial footing and clarity. So in fact, renting can free up margin in the budget for, like we said, generosity, more into ministry, and flexibility. I think I just say this because home ownership comes with those hidden costs of repairs, higher insurance, taxes, maintenance, all of which can be siphon the money and the time away from other things. So for some, I'd say especially singles, retirees, maybe they're relocating, definitely missionaries, renting can reduce stress in specific seasons of your life. You can glorify God in all housing decisions, whether renting or owning. So I want to say that to those that rent or in a position that renting is what they're currently doing, it makes some financial sense, contrary to what maybe you're hearing in the culture. So if you don't see yourself staying put in a house for 5 years, that'd be one time where I suggest maybe wise not to buy. Staying at least 5 years helps ensure that buying a home is financially and personally worthwhile. So as you think through, you got to recover closing costs. Many of the early years of your loan repayment is very interest heavy. So 5 years would be kind of a time frame when you're purchasing a house. So bottom line, in short, renting is not a lesser path. Renting is a place, still providing a place for you to live. That is the important thing. So as we think through the economics of home buying, know the strategy and time to rent. Before you get around to purchasing a home, there are some wise things to think through as sort of a checklist. So if handled rightly, the home mortgage can be a safe long-term investment as you work to own it outright over time. So we'll look at wise goals in home buying. So why 20% down when buying a home? You might hear this. The larger the down payment you can make, the better. This is great. So, but 20% is usually a very popular amount thrown out. So why 20%? On a $150,000 house, that down payment would be $30,000. So why do we hear that? A few reasons. First, 20% gets you out of private mortgage insurance, or PMI. This is an extra charge that the bank puts on you because they are unsure of your ability to repay the loan. So say your mortgage is $175,000 after your down payment, where you put 5% down. Being less than 20%, you would be subject to PMI. Your PMI could be an additional monthly payment ranging from $50 to $200, whatever the lending institution's PMI requirements are. Second, and less talked about with the 20% down payment, you can reduce the amount you need to borrow, making your monthly payments smaller, obviously. So a bigger down payment equals a smaller loan payment, equals a lower monthly mortgage payment. You also pay less interest over time because you're borrowing less, and that just makes a lot of sense in that. So third, you'll likely qualify for a better interest rate altogether. Lenders view 20% down as obviously less risky. so you often qualify for lower mortgage rates. Even a quarter percent lower rate can save you thousands over the life of the loan. And fourth, more equity from day one. You're going to start with instant equity at 20%, which is useful if you want to refinance later. Say you've purchased it at a higher interest rate. You need to maybe borrow against your home through a HELOC, or the market dips slightly. Maybe it doesn't appreciate quite as you expected over the first few years, but if you have 20% down, you're already built in equity. And so that helps with the fifth point. There's less risk of being underwater. If your home value drops, you're less likely to owe more than your house is worth. You get out ahead of any fluctuations. And this protects you if you need to sell or refinance, like I mentioned. And six, greater flexibility on bigger ticket items. Lower payments mean more room in your budget for home repairs, more room in your budget for those emergencies or other investments. The second thing I would say is use fixed rate loans. So while a 50% fixed rate loan is the ideal or the best situation you could come through or come to if you're needing a mortgage payment, there are many that stretch that to a 20-year or 30-year loans. These gimmick rate loans that are built to benefit the lender in the long run are ones to avoid and stay away from. So if the loan seems too good to be true, it probably is. Think of an adjustable rate mortgage that are very tempting to folks to get into home ownership. So an alluring lower rate seems nice for the first few years, and then it jumps to the market rate. And then suddenly it's just susceptible to interest rate rises then at that point going forward. It's adjustable. So it creates uncertainty. And then your monthly payment fluctuates, and that creates the impact and the stress on the budget. So on this slide, this is kind of what I'm showing here, different levels of down payments. So if we had a 5% down payment on a $175,000 home, our down payment would be the $8,750. We would need a loan amount of the $166,250. And if we broke that into a 30-year mortgage and 15-year mortgage, just for comparison's sake, you would see the total interest on a 30-year loan, you would pay $220,355. Then on a 15-year loan, $95,124. And as you work your way through that chart, you can see the contrasting differences in what you're paying for over the life of the loans. So wanted to just kind of show you that in a visual. So the biggest thing we need to think through as stewards is that housing choices are often driven by things like pride, covetousness, or desire for social status. Christians must be cautious not to buy more house than they can afford just to keep up with others. So instead, our decision should reflect contentment in godly priorities. So there are some slightly different approaches as to what is wise percentage that your housing expenses should take up in your budget. Most approaches include your mortgage payment, insurance, and taxes. What do those expenses, what percentage of my budget they can take up? Most recommend that those things, mortgage payment, insurance, your taxes, your utilities even, should be within 25 to 30% of your gross income. This ensures room in your budget for giving, saving, and other necessity and responsibilities. So many of those I have mentioned also warn against risky financial products like interest-only or adjustable rate mortgages. Rather than banking on appreciation or dual incomes, he encourages, many of the counselors encourage this wise families to base their decisions on one stable income and to buy conservatively. Some counsel says to wait until you're debt-free, specifically consumer debt, that is. There's great wisdom in that. As we know, debt crushes our budget. Being debt-free is a great friend to the budget. So we need to guard against making emotional decisions in housing purchases. Prayer, counsel. Just have a clear understanding of one's budget before taking on any major commitment. So believers must approach housing decisions with biblical wisdom, long-term stewardship in mind. None of the financial counselors forbid buying a house or taking out a loan to do so, but they all call for a caution in that. Your housing decision is a spiritual decision as we get to the heart of it. So to summarize practically, Don't stretch your budget just to get to a house you love. Buy what you can afford while still giving, saving, and living. Aim for housing costs to be no more than 25 to 30% of your monthly income. Use fixed rate mortgages. Plan ahead. Don't rush. Make sure your emergency fund is in place. Be content with less. Try to have your home paid off before a kid goes to college. But if that's not possible, shoot for having it paid off before retirement. So in the end, our homes are tools, not trophies. They should serve our families, support our calling, and honor the Lord. When we make housing decisions in line with biblical wisdom, we are not only protecting ourselves from unnecessary financial strain, we also reflect a heart that trusts God more than our stuff. So let's be people whose budgets, even our housing, testify that we belong to Christ. And lastly, on our seventh step, we're going to build wealth and give generously. The ultimate purpose of financial planning is not wealth, but generosity. So once we reach this stability and eliminated debt, you are free to live and give like no one else. So at this stage, you can increase giving, you can invest in others, and support kingdom work in very meaningful ways. So Scripture teaches that we are blessed to be a blessing, 2 Corinthians 9. Wealth should never become an idol, but rather a tool for service. So we're not chasing wealth. Our financial maturity means our budget reflects God's priorities. So every teacher agrees the final step is joyful generosity that overflows from a heart of gratitude. This is financial freedom, not to indulge, but while still enjoying what the Lord has provided, but to impact eternity as well. So we accumulate wealth to do this. So in this final section, I want to look at some of the wisdom and tools available to help us protect and manage well what we have been entrusted to steward. The first suggestion I want to make involves life insurance. Never a fun conversation with my clients, but death is real and we are not in control of our lives. We hit it head on here in our walk and realize of what Christ has done for us. So what I recommend while you're cleaning up your financial matters is really stretch it and put in place a term life insurance policy. The key word is term life there, not a whole life policy that parades around as an investment. The general rule is at least 10 times your present income and for maybe like a 20-year period. But look at your situation. Maybe a younger person in their 20s needs to go 30 years to get past maybe kids around in the house. The goal would be to replace your income in case you die. I suggest also taking a policy out on a non-income earning spouse as well. This would allow the surviving spouse to step back from working for a period of time, care for the immediate needs of the family as needed for as long as needed, not to stress any more than they are through the grieving process. So I strongly suggest some term life insurance for you. And not just, I've asked people, like, do you have a term life insurance? And they'll say, oh, yeah, my work provides a policy. Well, that's probably just a very small policy, and that would cover maybe your funeral expenses. So do some work and research in that area. I strongly suggest it. So one of the most common financial oversights people fail to make is to thinking about when you die. Not maybe just life insurance needs, but and I forgot to say, like, life insurance needs would help cover maybe your period of debt. You have debt you're still paying off. Maybe you still have the home to pay off. Those life insurance policies will help cover, get those things paid off so you can free up rest of your income to then live without the worries of maybe a larger financial burden hanging over you. But one of the other things that people fail to plan for is what happens after they die. So Scripture reminds us that we enter and leave this world with nothing, Ecclesiastes 5:15. So it's wise to steward our resources by deciding how they should be and would be handled after our passing. So a will is a critical tool to express these decisions. While Jesus didn't leave behind a legal will, it's fun to see how he demonstrated his intentional care for others, even at the moment of his pending death and departure from this earth in two ways. He committed his mother to John's care at the cross, And he also promised the Holy Spirit to his disciples. So in the same way, we should make preparations that serve and bless those we leave behind. And a few things on what a will does. A will is helpful to protect your children, and it communicates your wishes. One of the most important reasons to create a will if you have kids is to designate who will care for your children if say, both parents die. Without a will, the state decides guardianship, which can lead to obvious confusion or disputes among relatives or other potential caretakers. So choosing a guardian is an important discussion that needs to happen. So ideally, you're going to look for a trusted married couple who shares your values, your desire for Christian living, and desires your kids to still be in a stable environment. You should also discuss this responsibility with those potential guardians beforehand so they're not surprised come the day you need it. So definitely an important step in the process as well. Additionally, planning should include financial provision for your children. You can designate them as secondary beneficiaries on most policies like life insurance. And you can authorize, even through a will, the guardians to manage the funds on their behalf until they reach adulthood. I guess another point, a will directs the distribution of your assets. So without a will, your assets will be divided according to the state laws, which may not reflect your wishes and or your heart. So a will allows you to name primary and backup beneficiaries. Maybe you want to delay inheritance to your children until they're 25. They've matured a little bit to manage it well. Designate specific gifts or family heirlooms to certain people individually. You can leave portions of your estate to churches or charitable causes. So there's a lot of things you can do that's beneficial with the will on the distribution of your assets. So while it's common to divide those equally among children, it isn't required. So some parents may choose to allocate more to children in need. So say maybe someone is giving full time in the ministry, they want to give more to them. Or maybe one's been irresponsible and they don't want to give as much to them. You have to decide that in your heart. If you decide on an unequal distribution or leave part of your estate to ministries, it's wise to explain your reasoning to your family before maybe you pass or leave at least a letter stating so. This obviously, the last thing you want to do is create bitterness or confusion after you're gone. And I would even say, even if you're single or have no children, you should still have a will to direct your estate towards who you wanted it to go to. Maybe you have some relatives or close friends that align with you and you trust really well that you'd want to send that to. The other things that come up is maybe when to consider a trust. So for those of you with more maybe substantial assets, a legal trust may provide several advantages. So a trust outlines how assets should be handled. They can reduce estate taxes, helps the courts avoid probate delays and expenses through that. A trust is not a substitute for will. You need both. Seek legal advice, though. I don't spend a lot of time in that realm, but establishing a trust requires guidance, like I said, from people that are qualified to do so. And then organize your financial records for your family. So planning ahead also means keeping your financial affairs organized and accessible. Proverbs speaks positively of foresight. 2 Samuel 17:23. There was Ahithophel was commended for setting his house in order before his death. So loved ones often struggling to find bank accounts, insurance policies, or passwords. Like, where is all this stuff? It's a chaotic mess. Don't let them go through that in an already stressful time for them. So I guess, yeah, let them know. Maybe put all these things in a folder, a specific file, like your will and your trust documents, insurance policies, account numbers and passwords, and then specific maybe instructions that you'd like them to know. Then beyond money, the greatest inheritance you can leave is godly wisdom and faith. So Proverbs 3:13-15 says that wisdom is more valuable than silver or gold. True wisdom begins with the fear of the Lord, Proverbs 1:7. And it finds its fulfillment in Christ, who is the embodiment of God's wisdom, Colossians 2:3. As Christian stewards, our goal is to train others to treasure Christ above all and manage resources faithfully. And this includes teaching all that we own belongs to God, instilling a work ethic and sense of responsibility, modeling generosity and budgeting, warning against the dangers of debt and being enslaved, encouraging long-term planning and saving. So when your children understand and live by these truths, they will be more likely to steward any inheritance well. You may also choose to leave behind a written testimony of your faith, sharing how God has provided and sustained and saved you. Be sure they know that. Talk to them even before you pass. And last, we need to prepare spiritually and practically for death. Hebrews 9:27 reminds us, it is appointed for men to die once, and after this comes judgment. While we cannot know the timing of our death, we can prepare our hearts through the gospel and our families through intentional planning. So the most important preparation is spiritual, and to be reconciled to God through Christ, trusting Him in His atoning sacrifice. There's also great wisdom in financial preparation, like we've talked about this evening. Keep our affairs in order. We make a will. We entrust our family with the communication that they need. Death is certain, but its timing is unknown. As Christians, we are called to be faithful stewards of all God has entrusted us, including our finances, as we've talked about these last three lessons. So creating a will is simply a powerful act of stewardship. It ensures your wishes are respected and your children are protected, and your resources are used for God-honoring purposes even after you're gone. So leaving a financial inheritance can be a blessing, but leaving behind a legacy of faith, wisdom, and Christ-centered living is far more valuable. So plan well, not out of fear, but out of love and obedience to the one who owns it all. Let's pray.